Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello? Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here. We're here by phone today. We're having some struggles with technology. Hopefully, we'll get it going better here pretty soon. We're here also in theory. We will be here with Rod Bennett as soon as we can master our technological difficulties. Today is Wednesday, of course, in second week in Holy Week, and we're having a fine time of it. Tom McDonald on. We got Rod now? Nope, sounds like we don't. Okay. Anyway, we're in the second week of Easter, and things are bouncing along nicely as we continue to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. 40 days, you only have 40 days for Lent, but you get 50 days for Easter because, of course, life triumphs over death, and so that's symbolized in time as well. Thought might take a little bit of time today and look again at some of our reasons for believing in the resurrection of Christ. The resurrection of Christ is the absolute core of the faith. I was talking to someone recently. They were complaining because Christians talk about the persecution of Christians around the world, and they talk about the death of Christ. And he was saying, "You talk about the death of Jesus."
Call from
much.
Unknown caller. To add this caller to your current call, press 5. To accept, press 1. To send a voice.
Hello.
Hey, Rod.
I'm here.
You made it. Okay, good. We're having all kinds of technical difficulties today. I'm hoping we can get Skype working here soon. It's mysterious why sometimes Skype just doesn't decide to work for some reason. Anyway, how you doing? Hopefully we're still on the air. I can't tell. Maybe Ethan can send us a signal on Skype or something and let us know if we're still on the air. I think we are. Okay, I'm going to assume that we're on the air.
Okay.
Anyway, I was I thought it might be interesting to take a little bit of time today and look at some of the reasons for Christian faith in the resurrection of Christ. I was talking to somebody recently who said, Christians are just they're. They're so sensitive. They talk about evil, and why can't they just talk about happy things and not be talking about things like death? And so I remarked that a religion that begins with the murder of its founder is one that's going to have a certain sensitivity.
Also, the question begs pretty seriously the idea that we Christians get to decide what to talk about.
We get
when
to
we talk about our faith.
That's right.
That we're the ones in charge of what the content of it is.
Right, right.
Which begs the question pretty seriously. In other words, the whole idea behind the Christian faith is that we don't make it up, we pass it down.
Exactly. Not ours to make up.
That's right. So we can't, even though it's a day-to-day struggle for all of us not to edit out the parts we don't like and overemphasize our favorite parts. We all at least pay lip service to the idea that that's not within the area of our competence.
Right. Well, and, of course, the fact that virtually the only thing the Christian faith has ever had to say, the word gospel is an old English word, and it means good news. And the only news that the gospel has ever brought was Jesus Christ, the Son of God in human flesh, was crucified and raised from the dead. That's the news. The news
right.
is not, you know, the news is not niceness is nice, or you should try to love each other.
Well, all of those things are, all of those things, including all of the theology, are commentary on the news.
In other words, the news.
That's right. The news is Jesus Christ was murdered and he's alive again. Well, who's Jesus Christ? Well,
right.
I'm glad you asked that. And then you go off into questions of who Jesus Christ was, what he said, what sort of commands he gave, et cetera, all of which are commentary on the good news, which is the fact that he's somebody who's earned a right to a hearing.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the other thing that's mentioned is you could even point out, if you wanted to, that it's not returning from death after having died that makes Jesus stand out, because, of course, the Gospels themselves record other incidents of people who came back to life after being dead on a number of occasions. So Jairus's daughter and the widow of Nain's son and Lazarus, most famously, also returned from death. And the Gospels assert the truth of that, but there's the Gospels also insist that there's some kind of enormous qualitative difference between those resuscitations and what took place with Jesus.
Right. I would say that that most of Christ's miracles are aimed not so much as a kind of a sheer out of the blue test of, gee, this guy must be God because he does miracles. Most of them are have significance within the Old Testament framework. In other words, he's proving himself by his miracles, including the resurrection,
right,
to be the successor of the Hebrew prophets and the long prophesied greatest of the prophets, like unto Moses,
right,
the Hebrew Messiah. So most of the miracles are designed to validate that claim, and then you go back to, well, what did the Hebrews expect of their Messiah? What sort of person was, you know, whose son is David, you know?
Right.
And so that's, you know, that's the place for the miracles,
yeah,
really.
Yeah. And they're pointing forward as well. So, you know, for example, you get with the miracle of the loaves and fishes, John is very careful to locate in time that miracle during the Passover season, and so he wants to connect that consecration of
right.
bread and wine, if you will, in this case bread, to the Passover, because a year after this event takes place is going to be the great consummate Passover of the Last Supper, in which the miracle will no longer simply be looking back to the great act of redemption in the Exodus, in which Israel was led from death to life through, if you will, the waters of baptism in the Red Sea. It's going to now look forward to every Eucharist that will ever be celebrated ever again in the whole history of the Church.
Right, right.
What you see going on there then, and of course, what you see going on in the resurrection of Jesus is this. If you want to use that word, it's a kind of a transfiguration that's taking place of old into new. Right. And that's what the Gospels are all about. So they're saying that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament, but at the same time, they're saying that the Old Testament was always looking forward to this moment, to this event. And right. The resurrection, then, is a different kind of thing than the raising of Lazarus. Lazarus, the widow of Nain's son, Jairus' daughter, the other resurrections that you'll see people raised from the dead in the book of Acts, too.
Right.
They're all raised to natural life. So Lazarus is going to die again. And, you know, the little girl that Jesus raised, ultimately, at some point or another, she's going to get old and she's going to die, because those resurrections are not the kind of thing that the apostles witnessed with the risen Christ. His life is one that, as Hebrews calls it, is an indestructible life. The kind of life that he's been raised to is a glorified life. And that's what the New Testament is about. It's not about, primarily, it's not about sexual ethics and moral teaching or name your issue.
Well, once again, those things are commentary on the gospel.
Right,
In other words, this man was raised from the dead. Well, who is Jesus? And, well, here's who he is. What did he say? Well, these other things you've mentioned are some of the things he said.
Yeah.
Once his authority as a lawgiver is established, then what he laid down as the law becomes interesting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He's divine. And that's really the issue, is the question is not only what happened, so death and resurrection, but who did it happen to? And that's really what Easter is all about, Charlie Brown. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Rod Bennett talking about Easter and the resurrection. We'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We're talking about Easter, talking about the resurrection, which is what the faith is all about. It's really safe to say that apart from the news of Christ crucified and raised from the dead, Christianity basically has nothing else to say. It has no news beyond that. That's the only. It really puts all of its, if you will, it's all of its Easter eggs in one basket.
There's hardly any of Christ's moral or ethical message that hasn't been said before by previous sages. Often as well, and sometimes in the same words, or pretty close to the same words.
So the moral message of Jesus, I mean, what does Jesus come to say about the law of Moses, for example, which, you know, the law of Moses, that's been around for 13 centuries before Jesus, and basically he says, yeah, law of Moses, we're good, you know. And so he doesn't have anything new to say there. He does draw out some of the implications of the law of Moses in ways that were difficult not only for his contemporaries, but for us, too.
Well, I mean, if you accept the Christian conception of who Christ is, then the same person who talked through Moses is now talking through his own mouth.
Right,
and it's not surprising that the message should be similar.
Right, right. And so, you know, that's not news, and that's not what, you know, that's not what the you know, I've seen this. This is a trap sometimes that fundamentalist Protestants I've seen fall into, which is the notion that what the apostles came to bring us was the Bible. Well, no. I mean, the audience that they're talking to all have the Bible. They've got right. the Old Testament. They've been reading it for centuries. That's not the news. The news is that there are hidden implications to that Bible that were not seen. And the way that the apostles know they weren't seen is because the hidden implication of the Old Testament was put to death on a cross
yeah.
by the people who were the big experts in the Bible.
yeah, yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's why, that's what the apostles are saying is, no, there really is news here. Well, how do you know there's news? Because that guy that you put to death, that you were convinced was a false prophet, that guy was raised from the dead by God. And that's why we're convinced, say the apostles, that he is the fulfillment of the law. Plus, of course, he himself told us on the Emmaus Road after he was raised from death, that everything right. that was written in the law and the prophets was really about me. So the apostles are not saying that the big news is the Bible. The apostles are saying that the big news is that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Bible, of what's written in the Old Testament. And so their own writings, the New Testament, are going to be all about that. They're not going to be saying, hey, you should read the Old Testament more. They're going to be saying, this Old Testament you've been reading all along, there were implications there that none of us saw coming, because the apostles are as blindsided by this as anybody.
Right. We might say that he was the missing key that made a lot of things make sense more fully.
Yeah.
For the first time, that had been more mysterious before his coming.
Yeah. Yeah, and so. The natural questions that arise are, well, okay, but why should I believe this story that Jesus has been raised from the dead? And the apostles essentially answer that question with their lives. Why trust this story? Well, there are a number of reasons to trust the story. First of all, the apostles themselves obviously believe it. You know, if there's any fact of history that we can pin down, it's that, say what you will, the apostles are absolutely convinced this story is true. These guys are not liars. They do not act like liars.
Right.
And in, you know, in big and small things, what do they have to gain from it? What they're going to get? You know, Paul is going to, at one point, he sort of grumbles to the Corinthians, that he says, you know, it seems like we apostles have been, you know, put the very last, like, you know, like prisoners being dragged behind a triumphal car, you know, just despised by everybody. Everybody hates us. We're always getting run out of town on a rail, and we're just the dregs of the earth. What's in this for us? Well, the only thing that's in it for them is their absolute conviction that what has become of Jesus will happen to them if they are faithful to Jesus. And that's really it. You know, they don't have a lot of earthly gain out of this. And they're all going to, you know, every one of them is going to wind up getting killed, except for John, who's going to see everybody that he knows get killed, including his own brother.
Well, if you read the very earliest church fathers and other writings from the early centuries, from a pagan perspective, the main thing that was interesting about the Christian phenomenon was how blithely and cheerfully they went to their deaths. This
yeah.
gets repeated over and over again, and the pagans are fascinated by this.
Right. And
in other words, they all clung to life tenaciously.
Right.
And because, you know, the land of the dead, the three-headed dog, and all that sort of thing didn't sound too appealing, you know.
Right.
So they preferred to hang on to their present life as long as possible.
Right.
And they found people who were cheerfully convinced that they would go on to a reward, and if they died for this Christ, that there was a life afterward for them. And
right.
Keep in mind, it wasn't just a ghostly life of playing the harp amongst clouds as a see-through spirit, but a resurrection, you know. In other words, a bodily resurrection. That
yeah.
there was a resurrection ahead, and that that these, if they were killed, that they would rise to receive a reward.
Yeah.
And their willingness to do so, and their unwillingness on a very large scale to cling to the present life and avoid death in this world, was a great, great proof.
Yeah.
And it was almost always cited that they had seen Christ raised from the dead, or at least had heard about it from people who saw it, and this was one of the main things that convinced them.
Right.
And so
yeah.
you hear these pagan writers, that was the most practical and most obvious thing about Christianity, was these people were fearless of death because they had heard that it could be beat.
Yeah.
And were convinced of it.
And they lived, and this is, by the way, we were talking about this yesterday with Tom McDonald. One of the things that they insisted on was that Christ himself had told them that signs and wonders would follow the preaching of the gospel. And so what you see going on in the book of Acts, for example, is that all of a sudden these apostles, who were, you know, a pack of chicken-hearted dunderheads in the Gospels, are now doing the things that Jesus did.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not only, you know, passing on the traditions about what Jesus had said and done and wonders that he had performed, but they're doing them themselves.
Right.
So you get, you know, Peter... healing the cripple in the temple courts, right? There's a guy in the temple courts who had sat there for years and years. Everybody knew this guy, right? It was that guy that comes here every day, you know, and he sits here and begs because he can't walk. And it was the kind of thing that would really threw people for a loop, was not when you got some ringer from out of town, but you had some guy that everybody knew.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly healed and able to walk, and then the authorities do the same kinds of things that they had done with Jesus. They ask stupid questions that they already know the answers to, because they're baffled by this, and the result is, you know, what you see going on in the book of Acts is just this explosion of conversions that start taking place wherever the church goes.
Well, also an explosion of miracles, too. In other words, why quibble
right.
about the resurrection of Christ when you've seen men raised from the dead in your own community?
Right.
In other words, the scriptures tell us that all 12 of the apostles did all the same kinds of miracles that Jesus did.
Right.
The blind could see, the lame could walk, the dead were raised, etc. Well, there
yeah.
was one guy doing it before, now there's 12.
Now there's 12 guys, and they're going everywhere, you know?
Right. So,
and,
you know, why quibble about Christ's resurrection? I mean, it's going on all over the place, you know?
Yeah. And that was it, was that the church not only insisted that Christ was raised from the dead, they also insisted that he was somehow still doing things. That he hadn't just gone back to heaven and, okay, well, he's gone. The way the book of Acts begins, significantly, is Luke says in my former book, Theophilus, he's talking about the Gospel of Luke, of course, I told you everything that Jesus began to do and teach. Well, that word began is really significant.
Yep.
And it's pivotal to the New Testament theology of the church, which we will talk about in a minute. We are up against the break. So we'll be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Rod Bennett. We will be back on Redbox Media right after.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with Rod Bennett. We're talking about the resurrection today, the significance of the resurrection. And the resurrection is one of those things where you can spend a fair amount of time simply establishing the historicity of the resurrection, and that's an important thing to do because the resurrection really is it's an event that, although it has transcendent implications, the first thing to know about the resurrection is that it's a thing that happened at a particular place that you can locate using a GPS device. It didn't happen in Cloud Cuckoo Land, and it didn't happen once upon a time. It happened on a particular Sunday morning during the reign of a minor Roman procurator named Pontius Pilate at a specific address and specific coordinates right here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. It happened in space and time, as Dr. Francis Schaeffer
likes to point out. It happened in space and time. And people often start talking about the resurrection as though it were a thing like, the raising of Osiris, or his translation to the underworld, or whatever the myth is. It has, if you will, mythic implications, but it's a myth that became a fact. And so it's appropriate to spend time just sort of looking at why believe that this actually happened. Because if it didn't happen, as Paul says, then we are of all people most to be pitied. If Christ is not raised, then the dead are not raised, and you're still in your sins. And this whole thing is a huge waste of time.
and he advises us to blow it off.
Yeah. And so it becomes crucially important then to look at the evidence for it and so forth. And the evidence is straightforward, and it's there in the Gospels. And the problem of the resurrection, it's essentially the same problem as C.S. Lewis notes, is the problem facing anybody trying to come up with an alternative explanation of who Jesus is. That all the other explanations are just they're lame. They're super lame explanations of who Jesus. He was a nice prophet. Well, nice prophets don't go around claiming to be God.
There have been many people converted by the fact that the minute you start trying to treat Jesus as if he were another sage and a wise man, another Buddha or Confucius or whatever, the first thing you notice is how completely different he talks than they do.
Right.
They're always deferring you to the great, unknowable beyond them, that so far above them that it's silly to focus on them. I'm just a worm compared to the great glory of heaven or whatever. And
right.
Jesus doesn't do that. He says, he says, come worship me because I'm the answer.
Yeah, I am the way, the truth, and the life.
Yeah, just cling to everything I say and do everything I do because I'm the truth.
Yeah.
I'm not pointing you to the truth. I am the truth.
Right.
And it's so astounding.
And so that's the first key, is Jesus' own claim about his identity. And that is why he gets killed. It's because of his claims about himself that he's put to death. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? I am, which is a really loaded answer. In Hebrew,
word that they were not they didn't say too easily.
Yeah, exactly. And so he emphatically makes that claim for himself. Well, that's one of those later stories that were told about him by enthusiastic disciples. But in the early Gospels, he doesn't say those things about himself. It's the earliest Gospel, Mark, where we have Jesus making the most explicit claim about himself at the moment of his condemnation at the trial. It's Mark who tells us that Jesus' reply to that question of his identity is, I am. Other Gospels will put it slightly more obliquely. It's still an affirmative answer, by the way. Other Gospels will record him saying, you have said it. or, you know, something like that, which is still yes. That's still it's still an answer. But absolutely, you know, this is something that Jesus claims. And so that's the first thing that the Gospels you have to cope with, is that Jesus really does make this claim to be divine. And the other thing that you have to cope with is the absolute universal testimony of the early church that this person who showed up in their midst claiming to be God was then raised from the dead. And that they touched him, and that they ate fish with him. You know, John says, that which we have seen, which we have handled with our hands, this we proclaim to you concerning the word of life. And
as a funny little side note, apparently being resurrected makes you hungry. The gospel accounts. He raises the little girl from the dead, and the first thing he asks her mother, her family, is, can you bring her something to eat?
Give her some food, yeah.
That's right. Then the upper room, he asks for food and sits down and eats it in front of them.
Right.
Most incredible event in history, comes into the upper room and appears to them resurrected.
Man.
They've got a zillion questions to ask him, but it's got to wait till after breakfast. It says he took food and he sat down and ate it in front of them.
That's
in other words, they kept saying, "Jesus, but we want to ask." No. He's
yeah, in a minute.
His mouth's full. His mouth's full. So he's raising his hand and saying, "A minute."
I can't talk with my mouth full.
Yeah, right. And then later on the beach, when he opened their minds to the meaning of the scriptures and all the rest of it at the famous breakfast on the beach, after he's filled their boat with fish, the miraculous load of fish that he... first thing he does is he tells them to make a fire, or I think he does it himself, makes a fire and starts cooking breakfast. So being resurrected apparently makes you hungry.
I never thought about that, you know. and after, of course, after the raising of Lazarus, there's a huge banquet. Well, part of that, of course, is liturgical symbolism. So,
indeed, and also, of course, Jesus is at great pains to prove that he's not a ghost; that this is a physical resurrection. You know, a ghost doesn't sit down and eat food the way you're seeing me do.
Right, and the apostles, you know, is one of the interesting points. This is what N.T. Wright points out in his book on the resurrection of Jesus, is that the faith has never been about life after death. It's about life after death. So the apostles are quite ready to believe in a ghost. Ghosts are handy because ghosts can fade away, you know, and things like this, but
well, that's it. Just about everybody believed in a spiritual resurrection.
Sure. You know, that wasn't a big issue, you know. But the thing that gobsmacked the apostles was that the risen Christ wasn't a ghost. He could be touched, and he was... this is why, among other things, there's never, you know, in a church that will immediately begin to venerate the relics of her dead...
Mm.
And build we'll build altars at sites of tombs. That's why St. Peter's is where it is, because that's where Peter's buried.
Right.
It's built in a weird location, but that happens to be the location where Peter was buried. So that's where you build the church, because that's Peter's grave.
Yep.
Well,
the old Circus Maximus was there.
Yeah, but there's a church that's eventually built on the site of the Holy Sepulchre. But in the book of Acts, one of the significant silences, one of the dogs that doesn't bark in the book of Acts, is there's no activity that centers around the site of the tomb of Jesus in the book of Acts. The church, it just, you go there, you discover the tomb is empty, and then it just drops out of the story. Now, nobody ever goes back to that tomb to venerate the memory of Jesus or anything, because the way you remember Jesus is by remembering that he's alive, not by remembering that he's dead. And
also,
so
he set up a special memorial for himself.
Right. So there is a way to memorialize the death of Jesus, but it's the Eucharist. It's not visitations to the tomb.
Right.
And it's going to be a long time before the church sets up a Church of the Holy Sepulchre there. And that's significant as well. It's one of those, as I say, it's one of those dogs that doesn't bark. You will see the early church immediately gathering the relics of its saints and so forth. But the reason that the church will gather the relics of dead saints is because they are the bodies of those who are related to him who has now been raised to indestructible life. And so their bodies are going to share in the resurrection. That's why we venerate the relics.
Right. Well, also, they've been touched with grace. Grace is not just a theory. It's not just as Protestant theology has it, some sort of unmerited goodwill on God's part, although it is that, too.
Right.
There's actual power. The power of God.
Right.
Has rested on these bones. In other words, the bones are sacred because grace made them holy the same way that the steps that Jesus walked on during his passion are holy, because they were touched by God's grace in a way that a Protestant might call magical. In other words, they were affected by the live current that they were exposed to.
Sacramental power, man. Hey, we're up against the break, but we will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and you are here today with Rod Bennett. That is my co-host for today, and we've been talking about the resurrection. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, I believe you can call in at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. We're both talking on that number, so I know it works, because our Skype connection has gone AWOL today, so we're using the phone. But if you want to join the conversation, by all means, feel free. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. The fact that the resurrection, the death and resurrection of Jesus, is the good news. That's what the church has to bring to the table. What the faith has always, of course, instantly seen, and it gets this from Judaism as well, is that because of our relationship with God, therefore implications flow from that. So we are bound to love one another as Christ has loved us. Well, that's a tall order. Because, of course, the way Christ has loved us and the way he's shown us his love is by undergoing crucifixion for us. And so the implication of the faith is that we must, to the degree that we are graced and enabled to do it, we must undergo crucifixion for one another.
Oh, it gets more than an implication. The Apostle Paul says, if we have died with Christ, then we will be raised.
Yeah.
Well, what happens if we haven't died with him?
Yeah.
Well, there's an implication there, too.
Yeah.
And, of course, Jesus himself says, about as explicitly as it could be, he who does not pick up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me.
Right.
So that's explicit.
The staggering thing is that, as George MacDonald famously said, God is easy to please but hard to satisfy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we enter into this relationship with, well, what? Yikes. Okay, Jesus was crucified for us. What seven Herculean feats are going to be expected of us in order for us to make the grade? How can we possibly enter into relationship with God? that's bought, been bought at such a price. And so, you know, you could be expecting all kinds of, you know, massive, devastating demands on us from God. And then what you discover is, as a friend of mine named Tom Kreitzberg once observed, that a church that practices infant baptism does not have really rigorous membership requirements.
Yes,
how do you enter into this death and resurrection, this massive drama, this cosmic drama of a God who dies and rises from the dead? Well, here, come over here, and I'm going to pour some water over your head, and I'm going to
well,
say,
it's not coming in that's the trick, Mark. It's staying in.
It's staying in. But, you know, that's the amazing thing, is that all this life is poured out on us for free. Mm-hmm. And so we go, and we ask for baptism. If we're an adult, that's what I did. And if you're an infant, your mom and dad just they bring you to the baptismal font, and there's a splash of water over your head and the invocation of the Blessed Trinity, and look, you are now free of charge, a sharer in the very life of God Himself. And so that's the easy to please part. The hard to satisfy part is living out the rest of our lives. And Jesus warns us from the outset that being a disciple of Jesus is going to be hard. It's going to require us to lay down our lives, as you're saying. And it's not, again, typically, you know, most of us are not going to go to the starvation bunker at Auschwitz. You know, Maximilian Kolbe did. And that he was graced to do that. The rest of us have other things that we're asked to do. For another great saint, Thérèse of Lisieux, you know, her bearing of the cross consisted of, and this is something I think a lot of us can relate to, having to just get over just the white-hot sweat of irritation because the nun who sat next to her at evening prayer rattled her rosary beads in this irritating way.
Right.
And
well, that just, I think, is the real crux of MacDonald's quote. He really is easy to please. In other words, every night, with every whatever little victory you bring, he's very sincere when he says, "That's great, that's terrific."
Yeah.
But he's also very sincere when he says, "Okay, now, you ready for the next thing?"
Yeah, and, so
and that's the hard to satisfy part.
Yeah.
He loves every little victory, but immediately says, "Okay, now here comes the next lesson."
Right.
And a lot of times we want the last lesson to be good for a while, you know.
Right. Right. And that's true. Yeah, it is. It's a daily thing. Which is why, of course, we're told to ask for our daily bread. And that's all we get, by the way. You get your daily bread. Sometimes, you know, we, especially if we're prone to fearfulness, we can sort of hope that God is going to, like, stock us up on 20 years' worth of courage for whatever it is we're imagining is going to happen in the next 20 years, you know. But God lives with us in what has been called the sacrament of the present moment. That's where you find God. So God says, don't worry about tomorrow. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Tomorrow could be great. Tomorrow you might be dead. You know, I might be dead before I finish this sentence.
Well, he also promises that no matter what it's like, in several real important ways, it's going to be a lot like carrying a cross.
Yeah, but that he'll be with us.
Yeah.
And this is the whole. This is where we get past talking merely about Easter as though it were an historic event that took place a long time ago and is now disconnected from us. It's in the history books like the Battle of Valley Forge the assassination of Julius Caesar. It's a thing that happened once upon a time. The faith insists that Easter is not something that happened once upon a time. Easter is going on right now. Where two or three are gathered in his name, as we are right now, he is present with us. And we rely on him right now for the grace to do whatever it is we need to be doing in obedience to him. So right now for you and me, that means doing this radio show. But for other people, it can mean other things. You know, my brother-in-law right now is in the hospital. He underwent cancer surgery yesterday, and his wife is there with him. She needs grace as well, but she needs a different kind of grace to do different things than what we're doing right now. And by the way, I would ask you, you guys out there in Radioland, to please pray for my brother-in-law, Chris, as he has been battling cancer for the last few months, and we're hopeful that he may finally be out of the woods here, but he's got a recovery ahead of him, and it's going to be painful. So please pray for him. His name is
Chris. We will do that.
Chris, and his wife, Kathleen, who has borne an immense burden, just struggling along to make the business work and all the rest of it. So anyway, but that's also what Easter is about. Easter is about precisely the fact that Christ promises to supply us with whatever power it is we need for the thing that he has called us to do. And he absolutely promises that he will do that. And so it's amazing. You know, you look at the different kinds of things that God calls us to. Getting back to Thérèse of Lisieux, she once remarked that the way in which people are filled with grace, the image that she used was that, you know, some people are thimbles and other people are buckets and other people are swimming pools. And what God promises is that you will be as full as you are made to be by the Maker. So if God made you a swimming pool, he'll fill you with grace. And if he made you a thimble, you know what, and you're full of grace, you're as full of grace as a thimble is supposed to be. And that's fine, you know, and don't worry about the fact that you're not a swimming pool or that you're not a bucket or whatever. Just be, live in the moment and receive the grace that you have for the life that God has given you. That doesn't mean don't aspire to more. Absolutely, God loves us to aspire to more. But live in the present moment with the grace that God has given you. And God will see to it that you are increased, and that he increases grace as you increase in your capacity for it.
Excellent. A good word from Mark Shea.
Well, golly. We're coming up close to the end of the show. You got any final thoughts about Easter, Rod?
It's cool.
It's
let me give you, since we're just filling up a couple of last minutes, since our major points have been made, okay. This is an Easter point. You often hear people say, oh, let's look at that word Easter. That's a pagan name. You know, sometimes you'll hear this time of the year people say Easter was an incorporation of pagan festivals into Christianity, probably done about the time of Constantine. It's interesting. This is all a red herring because Easter is only used in English and German-speaking parts of the world. It's
right.
Just a nickname. It's just a local nickname. Most other parts of Christendom use some variation of Pascha or Pasqua or something along those lines, Passover. So,
you know, reminds me, I'm sure that when we're off the air today, we're all going to go rush off to worship Woden.
Because it's his day, right?
That's right, it's his day. So we
and tomorrow is Thor's day, a good day to watch the Avengers.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Rod. Our producer today was Ethan Boland. You've been listening to Connecting the...
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.